T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
For the first half of the hour, if I can keep them that long, my old broadcast partner from my New Jersey Devils days, Larry Brooks, who used to do the color commentary when I did the play-by-play, and of course, longtime columnist, Hall of Fame writer as well, in the NHL Hall of Fame, and we're going to get to him, and when we get to him, we will grill him like a tuna steak at an outdoor barbecue. And he wrote a great story on the Islanders, a team that he was very familiar with earlier in his career, and obviously that Islander dynasty of Goring and Potvin and Billy Smith and Nystrom and so on and so forth. He wrote a nice piece on them and their dominance and his memories of that, and a lot of people got a lot of enjoyment from reliving those Islander memories. We talked about Mike Vaccaro's column when we had Mike on last hour and the feedback he got. And I bet Larry got some good feedback as well about his Islander column today. And he joins us now on The Fan. Hello, Larry.
Let me hit that cough button.
Yeah, there you go. Hello, Larry. How you been, brother? How you been? Everybody all right?
Yeah, all good.
I'm glad to hear that. I want to get into it with you a little bit because you're a bright guy, and I know you have some overall thoughts about sports and in general how, you know, I asked Vaccaro about just trying to find silver linings to this whole thing and what we might take out of it from a positive side, and we'll get to that at some point. But your Islander stuff today rang true to some people, I'm sure, and it was a fun time for you. You know, you and I have talked about it a lot. Yeah. You know, I worked with Denny Potvin for a while.
So
I got close with him and got a lot of stories from him over years broadcasting the Panthers with him. But that was a special time for you personally, and what respect you had for Bill Torrey and his and Al Arbor and his team.
Yeah, you know, it was 40 years ago, and it does. It seems like it was yesterday. And talking to some guys who I generally keep in touch with, actually, you know, it's not that years and years and years go by without me talking to Bobby Nystrom or Bobby Bourne or Mike Bossy, who I talk to fairly frequently, or, you know, different guys. But it you know, the memories of the games in 1977 and 78 and 79 and 80 are as stark or maybe even starker than games that I covered 4 months ago. It was such a different it was such a different environment back then. The relationship between media people, between writers and the guys who covered the team and the players were so different. I mean, we were friends. we were essentially friends, and we'd go out together.
Yeah.
And you know, my wife and you know was friends with the players' wives. We would go out almost every Saturday night after games at the Coliseum to a place called Dr. G's, which was 5 or 10 minutes down the road. And you know, we would close it almost every early Sunday morning. And it was just a great time. The writers would travel with the teams. We would take the same commercial airline. We would stay in the same hotels. We would take the bus from the hotel to the rink and from the rink back, and from the hotel to the to the
airport. Yeah.
To the airport. Yep. Yeah. Yep. I mean, you know, you were part of the traveling party, and you know, there were lines, obviously, and there were boundaries, obviously, but there was so much more camaraderie. And, you know, maybe part of it was I was the same age, basically, as those guys were at that time. There wasn't that much difference in the money we were making at that time, you know, and it was just a traveling party. And there was, you know, incredible camaraderie. There were very few walls that came down. You know, you could go anywhere. You could talk to guys anytime you wanted to. It was just a different experience. And imagine starting your career as a reporter, as a hockey reporter. Imagine starting your career by covering the team that became perhaps the greatest team in the history of the league. And that's what it was. And honestly, I know it was the same for the guys covering the Flyers, about how articulate the players were and how willing they were to talk and how you would and I was, you know, at the Post at that time was a PM paper, which meant that our deadline was essentially get it in by 5 a.m. in the morning. Just get it in, you know. So I had so much time after games to talk to guys, and they would, you know, so we'd be in the back room of the Islander. They had two rooms. They had the one where they dressed in, and they had the one in the front where they put their equipment on and all. And you would go in, and I would go in, and I would spend like an hour or 2 hours in the back talking to these guys and drinking beer with them. I mean, you know, we would just sit there and talk and talk. And then we would go out, and then I'd come back at like 3 o'clock in the morning and I'd say, oh yeah, I got it right. And it was just such a different relationship. It was a situation where, if I started now, I don't know whether I would have kept at it. I really don't. I have no idea, but I do know that no one could have had a better start to their career than I did. I know that, and I think about it quite often. I was very, very fortunate to be where I was covering what became, I think, the greatest team in the history of hockey.
And
you just go down the list of guys who played and the memories, the game, the experiences on the road. It was a great, great time, and that was a great, great team.
Yeah, I mean, to win the number of series consecutively, and of course there's a little luck because there always is. That's the nature of sports in general and life in general, for that matter. Like you, I mean, how lucky were you to start your career at the exact time when that team, you know, was doing what it was doing. So we never discount luck in our conversations, but what a team. I mean, and what a group of characters, and Al Arbor being able to push the right buttons.
What a coach. Yeah. I mean, you know, that was a team with, as all group teams are, with massive egos in that room. I mean, there were massive egos, and why wouldn't you be? I mean, if you're Mike Bossy, why wouldn't you have an ego? You know, if you're Brian Trotche, why wouldn't you have an ego? If you're Denny Potvin, why wouldn't you have an ego? And Al not only coached them on the ice, he coached them off the ice. And you had the greatest players, conforming to his system. He was a remarkable coach. A remarkable coach. He knew how to get the best out of every player. I wouldn't say that he treated every player the same, because I don't think any coach can treat every player the same. Just as a parent can't treat every child the same, but he treated every player equally, and every player bought in, and they bought in because of Al, they bought in because of Bill, and they bought in because of peer pressure. And they were an incredible group of players. And I think that, you know, again, who knows what would have happened if they had played in Montreal.
Right.
Who knows what would have happened if they had played at the Garden. It had been the Rangers, let's say. Let me tell you something. For those seasons, no team in the history of the league was better. No team. And Montreal might have been equal. You know, they might have been in the 70s and the 50s. They might have been equal. The Oilers, who won 4 out of 5 and the 5 out of 7, might have been equal. But Edmonton never won more than 2 cups in a row. And the Islanders won 4. So that's, I respect the Oilers. You know, I got obviously to know, you know, Wayne Gretzky really well. And I got to know Mark Messier really well. And who wouldn't respect what the Edmonton Oilers did? But they never won more than 2 in a row.
Right.
And
right.
The Islanders won 4. So they won 19 straight series. And so their place in history is well established. And it's fortunate at times that it takes an anniversary like this to remind people of the greatness of that franchise. And certainly the issues over the last, decades have not been kind to the Islanders. But if it does take something like this to remind people about the Islanders, then all the better for it. And again, I'm writing about these things that happened 40 years ago. And to me, they happened yesterday. So it's a labor of love to write about those teams. It really
no
is.
Doubt about it. And, I've had enough conversations that I know that and how much you respected that time and just the way the whole mesh was. But I'm glad you told the stories about, just about how much of a family atmosphere it was.
Despite, yeah, well,
I don't think people have any idea about that. I do because I'm unfortunately close enough in age to you that I remember those times. But I don't think a lot of people understand how much more relaxed it was and how much easier it was and how much more fulfilling it was to be with a team back
right.
then, any team, but especially
right.
one that was winning because everyone's more relaxed when you're winning.
Right. Well, it's always better. You know, sometimes covering a bad team can yield better stories.
Right.
Especially if there's
right.
friction. And
right.
so, when you're covering a team, you're always rooting for the story. That's it. I mean, that's the sports reporter. I don't want to extend this to any other type of journalism because I don't know. But I know that when you're covering a team, you're always rooting for the best story. And sometimes when you're covering a bad team, the more poorly it does, the better the stories are. You know, players begin complaining, players begin talking off the record. You get better stories.
So let me get this straight. You're saying Billy Martin wasn't bad for the Post?
No, Billy Martin was not bad for the Post.
Okay, just checking. I just want to make sure it was clear.
Let me tell you this. The first Yankee road game I ever covered. What? No, listen to this.
I'm going to be listening. Trust me.
It was on a trip. It was in 1977, and I was sent down to Baltimore, and the Yankees were on a trip. And the first game was in Baltimore, and there was some issue with apparently Billy Martin and someone who was supposedly his niece.
Yeah, cousin. I think Claude Lemieux right. used to call him cousins.
Right, right. So, so my desk tells me to go to Billy Martin and ask him about this relationship. So listen, my mother didn't raise a fool,
right.
you know.
Right.
So I immediately called the Post. That, well, I could talk to him, and he had no comment.
he had no comment.
Right. But Billy Martin was not bad for the Post.
No.
Again, you root for the story. But with those teams, they were just so good that the story was how good they were. And they went through the 77, 78, they lost to Toronto, so they became a flawed team. Then they lost in 79 to the Rangers, and they became an even more flawed team. So, there were all stories to write about the Islanders, and they were so willing to engage in self-analysis. They would go in a club and say, and beat the Cleveland Barons 4-2 on a Sunday afternoon. And after the game, all they would do is castigate themselves for not beating them 9-0.
Right.
That was the kind of team they were.
Yes.
And, they were willing to engage all the time. You know, they were as great off the ice as they were on the ice, you know, for someone covering the team.
Yeah, and that's the way Al was, too, right? I mean,
Al was, too.
Yeah, you're not going to accept 4-2 when Al you could have been 7-0.
Al always knew how to take the – like, if the Islanders played poorly, he would either, you know, depending on what he felt was best, he would either go into a tirade of his own because he knew that would become the story and that would take the pressure off the players, or – depending on the mood and depending on the dynamic at the time, he would say, go ask them.
You know? Right, right.
He would stand up there and he'd say, Al, what, you know, they lose a game, yeah. You know, unaccountably, yeah. They play poorly. Al, what happened? Go ask them. And that was it, you know? And then you'd walk in and there would be 20 guys sitting there. Al says to ask you. You know? And and then they would just beat up on themselves.
Right. So they knew what that meant, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They knew what that
meant. It really was a remarkable time. They had all stars. They had, you know, third liners who were the best third liners. They had third pair defensemen who were the best third pair defensemen. I don't think there'll ever be another team like it.
All right. We don't have enough time to do all that I want to do. But where are we right now in this league, and how difficult is it logistically? You're a bright guy. You've been through a lot. I know we're all going through this particular issue together. We're all first timers. We're all novel, like the virus itself. But there are logistical issues that are clear. There is a need for gate in this league more than maybe the other leagues need gate. So. How do you put it in your blender and come out with some kind of a forecast for how this league can handle the rest of this year and then handle next year on the back of this year, should they be able to go?
Yeah, I think they're all doing their due diligence on this. I think they are all hopeful that they can come up with protocols that protect the players, protect personnel who will be involved, and be able to play a 2014 tournament that will result in a Stanley Cup win. And I think they're hoping they can get on the ice in July, and maybe the playoffs would go through September. That being said, there are so many obstacles between now and then. I don't know whether they're going to pull it off, and I don't think that they know whether they're going to be able to pull this off. I think all leagues looking to each other. I think, you know, when I see the baseball protocols where they're suggesting that there's social distancing and the fielders move away from the base runners when the ball's not in play and there are no high fives and you know, you can't touch elbows and you shouldn't shower at the ballpark. I wonder how the other three sports, hockey, basketball, and football, which are all contact sports, are possibly going to be able to play safely. But I also think that if the two sides can come up with protocols in which the players believe they're being protected, that they will try and play. And it's not for me to tell them not to. I don't know. There are a lot of issues. There are all the health issues. There are the quarantine issues. In order for the NHL to play, players are going to be in a hub city for maybe up to 3 months. You know, the teams that go to the semifinals and finals will probably be playing for 10 to 12 weeks. What does that exactly mean? Does that mean they separated from their families from 10 to 12 weeks? Can their families come visit them in the hotel in the hub city? You know, how many people will be allowed to visit? Will the players, you know, be permitted to leave their hotels? I don't know. I just don't know how this is going to work. But if the players and if the league can agree on protocols, then, you know, if they want to try and play, then let them try and play.
Yeah.
You know, it's just any business, honestly. Any business that opens is dealing with the unknown. I don't think professional sports in that way is radically different from any other sport, you know, any other business. except it's more visible. And I think that the people in charge of both the league and the union have everyone's interests at heart. I really do believe that. I don't think you'll see any sports starting if there is a real fear of exposing their personnel to danger. Now, listen. You know, the first sport. I don't know that any sport wants to be the first one to start. You know, that I don't know, and I certainly don't think the NHL should be first. Really, I don't think for the NHL to go first here. But I also think that the effort to try is worthwhile, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. If they start up and somehow a hot spot develops, then they'll shut down. I wouldn't blame them for that. I don't blame anyone for anything at this point, except being cavalier. And I don't think anyone involved here is being cavalier.
Fair enough. Let's finish with the human side and not the sports writer side. Any silver linings come out of this as you look at it from, you know, from a personal side? I talked to Vaccaro about this a little bit. You know, he said maybe people will be a little bit more appreciative of what they do have and appreciative and from a sports standpoint of, you know, the rhythm. And I was talking to him about the rhythm of a baseball season and how when you have nothing going on and it's a Wednesday night, at least you got the game on when you get home, you know, that kind of thing that we're all missing right now. You got any thoughts on that, on any silver linings out of this pandemic?
Yeah, I don't really see very many silver linings.
Yeah.
But I will say that it was maybe two weekends ago that I got in the car, actually, and I rarely go anywhere. I do, but I was going up to visit my grandchildren, actually, just to wave at them in the backyard, in their backyard. And it was a warm day, and I got in the car. And the first thing I did was look for a baseball game.
Right.
Honestly, I looked and I thought to myself, "Oh, of course there's no baseball game.
I'm going to be looking a long time."
Yeah. No, I know. But that was, you know, it was warm, and I was getting in the car, and it was in May, and I was like, "Oh yeah, well, are the Yankees playing? Or the Mets playing?
Right.
You know, what's the game?" So I'm not sure that there are silver linings. You know, you like to think that people appreciate, you know, the things that really matter, and maybe while we're all going through this, we do. But as soon as restrictions are relaxed, as soon as things return to normal, you know, or quasi-normal, whatever that is, whenever that is, we're all going to revert to our quasi-normal self. About the announcers, you know, we're going to be upset about the call at second base. We're going to be fuming that the Ranger game, it doesn't start until 8:30,
right,
to start at 7 o'clock. We always fall back into our particular habits, and so I'm not sure. I'd like to think that, you know, maybe our best our best selves emerge after something like this, but, you know, I'm old enough to know that that's probably not going to be the case.
Fair enough, Brooksy. Yeah. I'm glad you're healthy. Best to your family. Best to the great Jordy, and hopefully all continues well for you, and thanks for sharing a half hour with us tonight. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. Anytime.
There you go. That's the great Larry Brooks, Hall of Famer from the New York Post, NHL Hall of Fame, and obviously a great columnist, and has covered his share of baseball as well over the years for the Post, and funny Billy Martin story there, I have to admit.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.